Osho, the Diamond Sutra, talks on Vajracchedika Prajnaparamita Sutra of Gautama the Buddha, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 1.
Bhagwan, thus I have heard at one time, the Lord dwelt at Srivasti. Early in the morning the Lord dressed, put on his cloak, took his bowl, and entered the great city of Srivasti to collect alms. When he had eaten and returned from his round, the Lord put away his bowl and cloak, washed his feet, and sat down on the seat arranged for him, crossing his legs, holding his body upright, and mindfully fixing his attention in front of him. Then many monks approached to where the Lord was, saluted his feet with their heads, thrice walked round him to the right, and sat down on one side. At that time the Venerable Subhuti came to the assembly, and sat down. Then he rose from his seat, put his upper robe over one shoulder, placed his right knee on the ground, bent forth his folded hands towards the Lord, and said to the Lord, "It is wonderful, O Lord, it is exceedingly wonderful, O well-gone, how much the Bodhisattvas, the great beings, have been helped with the greatest help by the Tathagata. How then, O Lord, should one who has set out in the Bodhisattva vehicle stand? How progress, how control the thoughts?" After these words, the Lord said to Subhuti, "Therefore, Subhuti, listen well and attentively. Someone who has set out in the vehicle of the Bodhisattva should produce a thought in this manner. As many beings as there are in the universe of beings, comprehended under the term beings, all these must I lead to Nirvana, into that realm of Nirvana which leaves nothing behind. And yet, although innumerable beings have thus been led to Nirvana, no being at all has been led to Nirvana. And why? If in a Bodhisattva the notion of a being should take place, he could not be called a Bodhi being. And why? He is not to be called a Bodhi being in whom the notion of a self or of a being should take place, or the notion of a living soul or of a person."
I love Gautama the Buddha because he represents to me the essential core of religion. He is not the founder of Buddhism. Buddhism is a byproduct. But he is the beginner of a totally different kind of religion in the world. He is the founder of a religionless religion. He has propounded not religion but religiousness. And this is a great radical change in the history of human consciousness. Before Buddha, there were religions, but never a pure religiousness. Man was not yet mature. With Buddha, humanity enters into a mature age. All human beings have not yet entered into that, that's true. But Buddha has heralded the path. Buddha has opened the gateless gate. It takes time for a human being to understand such a deep message. Buddha's message is the deepest ever. Nobody has done the work that Buddha has done, the way he has done. Nobody represents pure fragrance. Other founders of religions, other enlightened people have compromised with their ideals. Buddha remains uncompromised. Hence his purity. He does not care what you can understand. He cares only what the truth is. And he says it without being worried whether you understand it or not. In a way, this looks harsh. In another way, this is great compassion. Truth has to be said as it is. The moment you compromise, the moment you bring truth to the ordinary level of human consciousness, it loses its soul. It becomes superficial. It becomes a dead thing. You cannot bring truth to the level of human beings. Human beings have to be led to the level of truth. That is Buddha's great work. 25 centuries before, just someday, early morning, just like this day, this sutra was born. 1,250 monks were present. It happened in the city of Sravasti. It was a great city of those days. The word Sravasti means the city of glory. It was one of the glorious cities of ancient India. It had 900,000 families in it. Now that city has completely disappeared. A very, very small village exists. You will not find even its name on any map. Even the name has disappeared. Now it is called Sahet Mahet. It is impossible to believe that such a great city had existed there. This is the way of life. Things go on changing. Cities turn into cemeteries. Cemeteries turn into cities. Life is a flux. Buddha must have loved this city of Sravasti, because out of 45 years of his ministry, he stayed in Sravasti 25 years. He must have loved the people. The people must have been of a very evolved consciousness. All the great sutras of Buddha, almost all were born in Sravasti. This sutra, the Diamond Sutra, was also born in Sravasti. The Sanskrit name of this sutra is Vajra Chedika Pragya Paramita Sutra. It means perfection of wisdom which cuts like a thunderbolt. If you allow, Buddha can cut you like a thunderbolt. He can behead you. He can kill you and help you to be reborn. A Buddha has to be both. a murderer and a mother. On the one hand, he has to kill. On another hand, he has to give a new being to you. The new being is possible only when the old has been destroyed. Only on the ashes of old, the new is born. Man is a phoenix. The mythological bird, phoenix, is not just a mythology. It is a metaphor. It stands for man. That phoenix nowhere exists except in man. Man is the being who has to die to be reborn. That's what Jesus said to Nicodemus. Nicodemus was a professor, a learned man, a rabbi, a member of the board that controlled the great temple of Jerusalem. One dark night he came to see Jesus. He could not gather courage to come to him in the daytime. He was afraid what people will say. He was so respectful, so much respected, going to a vagabond teacher, going to somebody who is hated by all the rabbis and all the learned people, going to somebody who moves with thieves and drunkards and prostitutes. But something in him was very desirous to see this man. Maybe he had seen Jesus walking, coming to the temple. He must have felt something deep in his unconscious for this man. He could not hold himself. One night when everybody has left, even the disciples had gone to sleep, he reached Jesus and he asked, "What should I do so that I can also enter into the kingdom of God?" And Jesus said, "Unless you die, nothing is possible. If you die, only then you can enter into the kingdom of God. You will have to die as you are. Only then you can be born as really your inner being is. The ego has to die for the essential being to surface." That is the meaning of Pragya Paramita Vajra Chediga. It cuts like a thunderbolt. In one stroke, it can destroy you. It is one of the greatest sermons of Buddha. Get in tune with it. Before we enter into the sutra, few things to be understood that will help to understand it. Gautama the Buddha has taught a spirituality that is non-repressive and non-ideological. That is a very rare phenomenon. The ordinary kind of spirituality, the garden variety, is very repressive. It depends on repression. It does not transform man. It only cripples man. It does not liberate man. It enslaves man. It is oppressive. It is ugly. Listen to these words of Thomas A. Kempis, author of Imitation of Christ. He writes, The more violence you do to yourself, the greater will be your growth in grace. There is no other way save of daily mortification. To despise oneself is the best and the most perfect counsel. There are thousands of saints down the ages who will agree with Thomas A. Kempis. And Thomas A. Kempis is pathological. Or the French priest Bossu says, "Cursed be the earth, cursed be the earth, a thousand times cursed be the earth." Why? Why the earth should be cursed? Life has to be cursed. These people have been thinking as if God is against life, as if life is against God. Life is God. There is no antagonism. There is no separation even. They are not different things. They are two names for one reality. Remember this, Buddha is non-repressive. And if you find Buddhist monks to be repressive, remember, they have not understood Buddha at all. They have brought their own pathology into his teachings. And Buddha is non-ideological. He gives no ideology, because all ideologies are of the mind. And if ideologies are of the mind, they cannot take you beyond the mind. No ideology can become a bridge to reach beyond the mind. All ideologies have to be dropped. Only then the mind will be dropped. Buddha believes in no ideals either, because all ideals create tension and conflict in man. They divide. They create anguish. You are one thing and they want you to be something else. Between these two, you are stretched, torn apart. Ideals create misery. Ideals create schizophrenia. The more ideals there are, the more people will be schizophrenic. They will be split. Only a non-ideological consciousness can avoid being split. And if you are split, how you can be happy? How you can be silent? How can you know anything of peace, of stillness? The ideological person is continuously fighting with himself. Each moment there is conflict. He lives in conflict. He lives in confusion. Because he cannot decide who really he is, the ideal or the reality. He cannot trust himself. He becomes afraid of himself. He loses confidence. And once a man loses confidence, he loses all glory. Then he is ready to become a slave to anybody, to any priest, to any politician. Then he is just ready, waiting to fall in some trap. Why people become followers? Why people are trapped? Why people fall for a Joseph Stalin or a Adolf Hitler or a Mao Zedong? Why in the first place? They have become so shaky, the ideological confusion has shaken them from their very roots. Now they cannot stand on their own. They want somebody to lean to. They cannot move on their own. They don't know who they are. They need somebody to tell them that you are this or that. They need an identity to be given to them. They have forgotten their self and their nature. Adolf Hitler's and Joseph Stalin's and Mao Zedong's will be coming again and again until and unless man drops all ideologies. And remember, when I say all ideologies, I mean all ideologies. I don't make any distinction between noble ideologies and not so noble. All ideologies are dangerous. In fact, the noble ideologies are more dangerous. Because they have more seductive power. They are more persuasive. But ideology as such is a disease, exactly a disease, because you become two, the ideal and you. And the you that you are is condemned, and the you that you are not is praised. Now you are getting into trouble. Now sooner or later you will be neurotic, psychotic or something. Buddha has given a non-repressive way of life and non-ideological too. That's why he does not talk about God. He does not talk about heaven. He does not talk about any future. He does not give you anything to hold. He takes everything away from you. He takes even yourself. He goes on taking things away. And finally, he takes even the idea of self, I, ego. He leaves only pure emptiness behind. And this is very difficult. This is very difficult because we have completely forgotten how to give. We only know how to take. We go on taking everything. I take the exam, and I take the wife, and I take even the afternoon nap. You go on taking. Even afternoon nap, you take a thing which cannot be taken. You have to surrender to it. Sleep comes only when you surrender. Even a wife, a husband, you go on taking. You are not respectful. The wife is not a property. You can take a house. How can you take a wife or a husband? But our language shows our mind. We don't know how to give, how to give in, how to let go, how let things happen. Buddha takes all ideals away, the whole future away. And finally, he takes the last thing that is very, very difficult for us to give. He takes your very self, leaves a pure, innocent, virgin emptiness behind. That virgin emptiness he calls nirvana. Nirvana is not a goal. It is just your emptiness. When you have dropped all that you have accumulated, when you don't hoard any more, when you are no more a miser and a clinger, then suddenly that emptiness erupts. It has always been there. Hakun is right. From the very beginning, all beings are Buddhas. that emptiness is there. You have accumulated junk, so that emptiness is not visible. It is just like in your house, you can go on accumulating things. Then you stop seeing any space. Then there is no more space. A day comes, even to move in the house becomes difficult. To live becomes difficult because there is no space. But space has not gone anywhere. Think of it. Meditate over it. The space has not gone anywhere. You have accumulated too much furniture in the TV and the radio and the radiogram and the piano and everything. But the space has not gone anywhere. Remove the furniture out and the space is there. It has always been there. It was hidden by the furniture, but it was not destroyed. It has not left the room, not for a single moment. So is your inner emptiness, your nirvana, your nothingness. Buddha does not give you nirvana as an ideal. Buddha liberates instead of coercing. Buddha teaches you how to live, not for any goal, not to achieve anything, but to be blissful here now. How to live in awareness. Not that awareness is going to give you something. Awareness is not a means to anything. It is the end in itself. The means and the end both. Its value is intrinsic. Buddha does not teach you otherworldliness. This has to be understood. People are worldly. The priests go on teaching the other world. The other world is also not very otherworldly. It cannot be. Because it is just an improved model of the same world. From where you can create the other world? You know only this world. You can improve. You can decorate the other world better. You can remove few things that are ugly here and you can replace few things which you think will be beautiful. But it is going to be a creation out of the experience of this world. So your other world is not very different. Cannot be. It is a continuity. It comes out of your mind. It is a game of imagination. You will have beautiful women there. Of course, more beautiful than you have here. You will have the same kinds of pleasures there. Maybe more permanent, stable. But they will be the same kind of pleasures. You will have better food, more tasty, but you will have food. You will have houses, maybe made of gold, but they will be houses. You will repeat the whole thing again. Just go into the scriptures and see how they depict the heaven. And you will find the same world improved upon. Few touches here and few touches there. But it is not in any way otherworldly. That's why I say the otherworldliness of other religions is not much otherworldly. It is this world projected in the future. It is born out of the experience of this world. There will not be misery and poverty and illness and paralysis and blindness and deafness. Things that you don't like here will not be there, and things that you like will be here and in abundance. But it is not going to be anything new. Mind cannot conceive of anything new. Mind is incapable of conceiving the new. Mind lives in the old. Mind is the old. The new never happens through the mind. The new happens only when mind is not functioning. When mind is not controlling you. When mind has been put aside. The new happens only when the mind is not interfering. But all your scriptures talk about the heaven, and the heaven or the paradise or Firdaus or Swarga is nothing. But the same story may be printed on a better art paper, with better ink, in a more improved press, with more colorful illustrations. But the story is the same. It cannot be otherwise. Buddha does not talk of other worldliness or the other worlds. He simply teaches you how to be here in this world, how to be here alert, conscious, mindful, so that nothing impinges upon your emptiness, so that your inner emptiness is not culminated poisoned, so that you can live here and yet remain uncontaminated, unpolluted, so that you can be in the world and the world will not be in you. The otherworldly spirituality is bound to be oppressive, destructive, sadomasochistic, in short, pathological. Buddha's spirituality has a different flavor to it. The flavor of no ideal, the flavor of no future, the flavor of no other world. It is a flower here and now. It asks for nothing. All is already given. It simply becomes more alert, so you can see more, you can hear more, you can be more. Remember, you are only in the same proportion as you are conscious. If you want to be more conscious. Consciousness imparts being. Unconsciousness takes being away. When you are drunk, you lose being. When you are fast asleep, you lose being. Have you not watched it? When you are alert, you have a different quality. You are centered, rooted. When you are alert, you feel the solidity of your being. It is almost tangible. When you are unconscious, just dragging by, sleepy, your sense of being is less. It is always in the same proportion as the consciousness is. So Buddha's whole message is to be conscious. and for no other reason, just for the sake of being conscious, because consciousness imparts being. Consciousness creates you, and you so different from you that you are, that you cannot imagine. A you where I has disappeared, where no idea of self exists, nothing defines you, a pure emptiness, an infinity, unbounded emptiness. This Buddha calls the state of meditation Samma Samadhi, right state of meditation, when you are all alone. But remember, aloneness is not loneliness. Have you ever thought about this beautiful word, alone? It means all one. It is made of two words, all and one. In aloneness, you become one with the all. Aloneness has nothing of the loneliness in it. You are not lonely when you are alone. You are alone but not lonely, because you are one with the all. How you can be lonely? You don't miss others, true. Not that you have forgotten them. Not that you don't need them. Not that you don't care about them. No. You don't remember others because you are one with them. All the distinction between one and all is lost. One has become the all and all has become one. This English word alone is immensely beautiful. Buddha says Samma Samadhi is aloneness. The right meditation is to be so utterly alone that you are one with all. Let me explain it to you. If you are empty, your boundaries disappear, because emptiness can have no boundaries. Emptiness can only be infinite. Emptiness cannot have any weight. Emptiness cannot have any color. Emptiness cannot have any name. Emptiness cannot have any form. When you are empty, how you will divide yourself from others? Because you don't have any color, you don't have any name, you don't have any form, you don't have any boundaries. How you are going to make any distinctions? When you are empty, you are one with all. You have melted into existence. Existence has merged with you. You are no more an island. You have become the vast continent of being. Buddha's whole message is condensed in this one word, Samma Samadhi, right meditation. What is right meditation and what is wrong meditation? If the meditator exists, then it is wrong meditation. If the meditator is lost in meditation, then it is right meditation. Right meditation brings you to emptiness and aloneness. This sutra, this whole sutra is concerned how to become utterly empty. This is his basic gift to the world. Thus have I heard at one time. These sutras have been remembered by Buddha's great disciple Ananda. And one thing to be remembered, all sutras start, "Thus have I heard." When Buddha died, all the disciples gathered together to collect whatsoever Buddha has said in those 45 years. Only Ananda was the one who has lived continuously in those 45 years with Buddha. He was the most authentic to be relied upon. Others have heard, but they have heard from others. Sometimes they were with Buddha and sometimes they were not with Buddha. Only Ananda has lived like a shadow. So Ananda relates. But the beauty is that he never says that Buddha said this. He simply says, "Thus have I heard." The difference is great. He does not say Buddha has said this, because he says, "How am I to say what Buddha has said? All that I can say is this, that this is what I have heard. What Buddha said, only he knows. What he meant, only he knows. All that I can remember is what I have heard. My capacities are limited." He may have meant something else. I may have forgotten few words. I may have put few words of my own. This is a great sincerity. He could have claimed that this is what Buddha said. I was present. I am an eyewitness. And he was an eyewitness. Nobody can deny that. But look at the humbleness of the man. He says, "Thus have I heard." Buddha was saying, "I was hearing. I can only relate what I have heard. It may be right, it may not be right. I may have interfered, I may have interpreted, I may have forgotten few things, something of my own mind may have got into it, that all is possible. I am not an enlightened man." Ananda was not yet enlightened. So he says, "This is all that I can say. I can watch far. Thus have I heard at one time. The Lord dwelt at Sravasti. Early in the morning, the Lord dressed, put on his cloak, took his bowl, and entered the great city of Sravasti to collect alms. When he had eaten and returned from his rounds, the Lord put away his bowl and cloak, washed his feet, and sat down on the seat arranged for him, crossing his legs, holding his body upright, and mindfully fixing his attention in front of him." This you will be surprised when Ananda says he goes into very small details. One never knows. When you are reporting about a Buddha, you have to be very careful. Even this much he reports again and again. Such small things. Early in the morning, the Lord dressed, put on his cloak, took his bowl, and entered the great city of Sravasti to collect alms. Ananda is following like a shadow, a silent shadow, just watching him. Just to watch him was a benediction. And he watches everything. When he had eaten and returned from his rounds, the Lord put away his bowl and cloak, washed his feet, and sat down on the seat arranged for him. When for the first time Buddhist sutras were translated into Western languages, the translators were a little bit puzzled. Why this continuous repetition? It goes on and on like that. Again it will be. Again this. Why these small things are related? They could not understand it. They thought this is repetitive, that this is a very unnecessary repetition, not needed at all. What is the point of it all? But they missed. What Ananda is saying is that Buddha pays attention to small things as much as to big things. For a Buddha, there is nothing small and nothing big, one thing. When he takes his bowl, he is as respectful to the bowl as he will be respectful to any god. When he puts his cloak or puts his dress on, he is so mindful. He is absolutely alert. He is not mechanical. When you put your dress on, you are mechanical. You know mechanically how to put it, so what is the point of paying attention to it? Your mind goes on moving into 1,000 directions and you take a shower, but you are very disrespectful to the shower. You have not been there. You have been somewhere else. You eat, but you are disrespectful to the food. You are not there. You simply go on swallowing the food inside you. You go on doing your things habitually, mechanically. When Buddha does a thing, he is utterly there. He is nowhere else. When he had eaten and returned from his round, the Lord put away his bowl and cloak, washed his feet, and sat down on the seat arranged for him, crossing his legs, holding his body upright, and mindfully fixing his attention in front of him. These minute details are worth relating because they bring the quality of Buddhahood. Each moment he lives in awareness. What he is doing is irrelevant. Each moment he pours his attention into whatsoever he is doing. When he makes a gesture, he is totally the gesture. When he smiles, he is totally the smile. When he talks, he is totally his words. And when he is silent, he is totally silent. To watch a Buddha is a blessing in itself. How he walks, how he sits, how he makes gestures, how he looks at you. Each moment is a radiant moment of awareness. That's why Ananda reports, there must have been great silence when Buddha came, arranged his dress, washed his feet, sat on the seat arranged for him, sat upright, then focused his whole attention in front of him. What is this fixing your attention in front of yourself? That is a special Buddhist method called Anapanasati Yoga. Mindfulness of breath coming in and breath going out. That is the meaning of focusing your attention in front. When Buddha is doing something, for example, dressing, then he is attentive of that act. When he is walking, he is attentive of walking. When he is not doing anything, then he is attentive of breath coming in and breath going out. But he is attentive. Even while he is asleep, he is attentive. Ananda has asked Buddha once. For 10 years he lived with Buddha, and he was surprised that he remains in the same posture the whole night. Wherever he puts his hand, he keeps it there the whole night. He must have looked many times, must have sneaked in the night. It was worth how the Buddha sleeps. And he was surprised and puzzled that he keeps the same posture, the whole night. He could not hold his curiosity. One day he said, "It is not right for me to get up in the night and look at you. I should not do such a thing, but I am curious about you. And I am puzzled. You remain in the same posture. Do you sleep? Are you continue your awareness?" And Buddha said, "Sleep happens in the body. I remain alert of it. Now the sleep is coming. Now it has come. Now it has settled. Now the body is relaxed, that the limbs are relaxed. But I keep burning my awareness bright." Meditation is a 24-hour thing. It is not that you do once a day and you are finished with it. It has to become your flavor. It has to become your climate. It should surround you wherever you are, whatsoever you are doing. And mindfully fixing his attention in front of him, he said, then many monks approached to where the Lord was, saluted his feet with their heads, thrice walked round him to the right and sat down on one side. To ask a question to a Buddha needs a certain attitude. Only then you will receive the answer. Not that Buddha will not give the answer. You can ask very disrespectfully, Buddha will give the answer, but you will not receive it. So it is not a question that only when you are respectful, then Buddha will give the answer. Buddha will give the answer anyway. But if you are not very respectful, very humble, receptive, feminine, you will miss it. How you ask the question determines whether you will be able to receive the answer or not. How you ask, in what mood, are you receptive? Are you just curious? Are you asking the question out of your accumulated knowledge? Or is your question innocent? Are you asking just to test whether this man knows or not? Are you asking from a state of knowledge or from a state of not knowing? Are you humble, surrendered? Are you ready to receive the gift if it is given to you? Will you be open? Will you welcome it? Will you take it to your heart? Will you allow it to become a seed in your heart? To ask a question to a Buddha is not to ask a question to a professor. It needs a certain quality in you. Then only you will be benefited by it. Then many monks approached to where the Lord was, saluted his feet with their heads, thrice walked round him to the right, and sat down on one side. Walking thrice is symbolic about the three bodies. The first round is for the physical body, the body that we can see, which is available to the senses. The physical body of the Buddha is also beautiful. It is the shrine where God abides. So the first round is a salutation for the first body, the physical body. The second round is for the bliss body, second body. And the third round is for the Buddha body, the truth body. These three rounds are symbolic of something else too. In Buddhism, there are three shelters, three refuges. I take refuge in the Buddha. I take refuge in the Sangha. I take refuge in the Dhamma. These three rounds are symbolic of them too. When a person comes to Buddha to ask anything, he has to take refuge. He has to have this state of mind that I am falling in tune with Buddha, that I am ready to vibrate in the same wavelength. I take refuge in the Buddha that you are my shelter. That I come to you as a disciple. That I come to you knowing that I don't know. That I come to you in innocence. That I bow down to you. That I recognize you that you know and I don't know. So I am ready to receive whatsoever you think I am worthy to be given to. I take refuge in the Sangha, in the commune. Because one Buddha is only a representative of all the Buddhas of the past and the future. One Buddha is a door to all the Buddhas. You can call the Buddhas the Christ or the Krishnas, it doesn't make any difference. These are different names given by different traditions. So the first refuge is in this Buddha, who is just in front of you. The second refuge is to all the Buddhas, the Sangha, the commune of the Buddhas, past, present, future. And the third refuge is in the Dhamma, that essential being that makes a man a Buddha. That art of awakening is Dhamma, the religion. At that time, the Venerable Subhuti came to that assembly and sat down. One of the great disciples of Buddha is Subhuti. Then he rose from his seat, says Ananda, and again he repeats the whole thing, because Subhuti is also no ordinary man. He is almost a Buddha, just on the verge of it. Any moment he is going to become a Buddha. So Ananda repeats again. Then he rose from his seat, put his upper robe over one shoulder, placed his right knee on the ground, bent forth his folded hands towards the Lord, and said to the Lord, "It is wonderful, O Lord, it is exceedingly wonderful. O Valgan, how much the Bodhisattvas, the great beings, have been helped with the greatest help by the Tathagata. How then, O Lord, should one who has set out in the Bodhisattva vehicle stand? How progress? How control the thoughts?" Subhuti is almost close to Buddhahood. He is a Bodhisattva. Bodhisattva means who is ready to become a Buddha, who has come almost close to it, one step more, and he will become a Buddha. Bodhisattva means Bodhi essence, Bodhi being, ready, 99 degrees, and on the 100 degree he will evaporate. But a Bodhisattva is one who tries to remain a little longer at the 99 degree so that he can help people out of his compassion. Because once he has jumped the 100 degree, he has gone beyond. Gate, gate, para gate, para samgate, bodhi swaha. Then he has gone and gone beyond and beyond. Then it will be very difficult to make contact to the people who live on this source. The greatest help is possible from those who are at the 99 degree. Why? Because they are still not enlightened. They know the ways of the people who are unenlightened. They know the language of the people who are unenlightened. They are yet with them. And yet, in another sense, 99% they have gone beyond. That 1% keeps them linked, bridged. So a Bodhisattva is one who is close to Buddhahood but is trying to remain on this shore a little more so that he can help people. He has arrived. He would like to share his arrival. He has known. He would like to share what he is known. Others are stumbling in darkness. He would like to share his light with them, his love with them. Subhuti is a Bodhisattva. Ananda reports about him also in the same way as he reports about Buddha. Then he rose from his seat. Just imagine, visualize a Bodhisattva rising. He is utter awareness. He is not just rising like a robot. Each breath is known, fully known. Nothing passes unknown. He is watchful. What the Catholic tradition says, recollectedness. That's what Buddhists call sammasati, right mindfulness. Mindfulness or recollection, to be recollected, to live recollectedly, sammasati. Not to do a single act unconsciously. He rose from his seat, put his upper robe over one shoulder, placed his right knee on the ground, bent forth his folded hands towards the Lord and said to the Lord, and remember, even a bodhisattva who has come very close to be a Buddha bows down to the Buddha in utter gratitude. It is wonderful, O Lord. It is exceedingly wonderful. O well gone. Well gone means one who has gone to the other source. Subhuti is on this source. Buddha is on that source. Subhuti has come to that understanding. He can see the other source. He can see Buddha on the other source. O well gone. This word well gone has many meanings. One has reached to the other source. Another, one who has reached to the ultimate of meditation. Buddha has said that there are 8 steps towards ultimate meditation. One who has reached to the 8th is called well gone. But it is the same. One who has reached samadhi, the ultimate samadhi, he has gone to the other source. He is no more. That is what is meant by well gone. Gone, utterly gone. He is no more. He is just an emptiness. The self has disappeared, evaporated. Oh, well gone. It is wonderful. It is exceedingly wonderful. How much the bodhisattvas, the great beings, have been held with the greatest help by the Tathagata. Tathagata is the Buddhist word which means well gone. Subhuti says, how much help has been given. How much, it is wonderful, it is exceedingly wonderful, it is unbelievable. How much you have given to us. And you go on giving. And we don't even deserve it. Wonderful. O Lord, it is exceedingly wonderful. O well gone, how much the bodhisattvas, the great beings, have been helped by the Tathagata. How then, O Lord, should one who has set out in the bodhisattva vehicle, one who has decided to remain on this shore a little longer to help people, how he should stand, how progress, how control the thoughts? What he is asking? He is asking a question which may not be relevant to many of you. Because it becomes relevant only when you have become a bodhisattva. But someday or other, you will be becoming bodhisattvas. Someday or other, the question will be relevant. It is better to think about it. It is better to meditate over it. He says, those who have decided to be bodhisattvas, how they should stand. He is saying the attraction of the other soul is so much. The pull of the other soul is so much. How they should stand on this soul. We would like to help people. But how? The pull is such. The magnetic pull is such. The other soul is calling. So teach us how we can stand here, how we can become again rooted on this shore. We have become uprooted. In this world we don't have any roots. 99% roots are gone. Just think of a tree. 99% roots are gone. Only 1% roots are there. The tree is asking, how should I stand now? I'm going to fall. And I understand that if I can stay a little longer, I will be of immense help to people and they need it. I was in need. You helped me. Now others are in need. I should help. That is the only way a disciple can pay his debt to the master. There is no other way. The master has helped you. The master needs no help how to pay the debt, what to do. The only way to do is help somebody who is still stumbling, groping in the dark. Do whatsoever the master has done for you to others, and you have paid your debt. He asks how to stand. It is difficult. It is almost impossible. And how to progress? How to start helping people? Because that too is difficult. Now we understand their miseries are all false. Now we understand that they are suffering just nightmares. Their miseries are not true. Now we know they are afraid only of a rope, thinking that it is a snake. Now it is very difficult to help these people. It is ridiculous. And we know that they need help because we know our own past. We were trembling, crying, screaming. We know how much we have suffered, although now we know that all suffering was just like a dream. It was illusory. It was Maya. Just think, if you know that the other person is just talking nonsense, that he has no wounds. Once a man was brought to me. He had got the idea somehow that two flies have entered into his stomach because he sleeps with open mouth. And they go on revolving in the stomach. Naturally, if they have entered, they will revolve. And he was continuously worried. And he was not even able to sit in one posture. He will move to this side and that, and he will say, they have gone to this side, and they have gone to this side. He was almost mad. Now, he has been to all the doctors, and nobody was of any help. And they all laughed. They said, you are just imagining. But just to say to a person that you are imagining your misery is not of much help. Because he is suffering. It may be imaginary to you, but to him it makes no difference whether the suffering is imaginary or real. He is suffering all the same. What you call it makes no difference. I touched his stomach and then said, yes, they are there. He was very happy. He touched my feet. He said, you are the only man. I have been to many doctors and physicians and Ayurvedic and the allopathic and the homeopathic, and they are all fools. And they go on insisting one thing. If you don't have any medicine, simply say that you don't have any medicine. But why you go on saying that I am imagining? Now here you are. Can't you see? I say, perfectly, I can see they are there. I deal in such problems. I said, you have come to the right person. This is my whole work. I deal in such problems which don't exist really. But I am an expert in dealing with problems which are not. I said, you just lie down and close your eyes. I will have to blindfold you. And I will take, and you open the mouth. And I will call them. A great mantra is needed. He was very happy. He said, this is how it should be done. I blindfolded him. Told him to open his mouth. And he was lying there very happy, waiting for the flies to come. And I rushed into the house to find two flies. It was difficult because I have never caught before. But somehow I managed. And when he opened his eyes and saw those two flies in the bottle, he says, now give this bottle to me. I have a girl to those fools. And he was perfectly okay. But it is very difficult to help such people. Very difficult. Because you know that their difficulty is all false. Subhuti is asking, Lord, first tell us how to stand here, because our roots are gone. We don't belong to this world anymore. Our attachments are gone. They are the roots. And how to progress to work? Because we now know that this is all just nonsense. People are imagining all their miseries. And how to control thoughts? What he means, because a bodhisattva has no thoughts ordinarily, not the thoughts that you have. Now there is only one thought, and that thought is of the other soul. And the other soul continuously pulls, and the door is open, and you can enter into utter bliss, and you are holding yourself on the door, and the door is open. First you were searching for many lives where the door is. Then you were knocking and knocking for many lives. Now the door is open. And Buddha says, you wait. You remain outside the door. There are many who have to be helped. Naturally, a great desire to enter, a great passion to enter into the door will arise. That's what he is asking. After these words, the Lord said to Subhuti, therefore, Subhuti, listen well and attentively. Someone who has set out in the vehicle of a bodhisattva should produce a thought in this manner. It doesn't look very good in the English translation. The Sanskrit word is chittopad. One should create such a mind, such a decision. One should create such a great decision, determination, chittopad, in this manner. As many beings as there are in the universe of beings, comprehended under the term beings, all these must lead to nirvana. Not one or two, vibhuti, subhuti, not one or two, but all the beings, men, women, animals, birds, trees, rocks, all the beings in the world, one should create such a determination that I will lead all them to nirvana, into that realm of nirvana which leaves nothing behind. And yet, although innumerable beings have thus been led to nirvana, no being at all has been led to nirvana. That too you have to remember. You should not forget. Otherwise, leading others, you will fall into ignorance again. All the beings have to be led to the other source, and still you have to remember that their miseries are false, so your remedies are also false. And you have to remember that they have no selves, neither you have any self. So don't forget that you are helping people, that you are a great helper, this and that. Otherwise you will fall again. Again you will grow roots on this soul. So two things have to be remembered. You have to remain on this soul with great determination. Otherwise you will be pulled by the others. And yet you are not to grow roots again. Otherwise you will not be of any help. You will destroy yourself. You will fall into the dream again. And why? If in a bodhisattva the notion of a being should take place, he could not be called a bodhi being. And why? He is not to be called a bodhi being in whom the notion of a self or of a being should take place, or the notion of a living soul or of a person. So you have to remember, Subhuti, two things. One, that you have to lead all the beings to the other soul, and still you have to remember that nobody has a being. Neither you nor they. All egos are false and illusory. Go on remembering this and go on with great determination. Help people to the other source. They are already there, just you have to make them alert and aware. But don't get lost. Don't become a savior. These two things. And again Buddha will repeat in this sutra, the vehicle of the bodhisattva. I would like you all to become bodhisattvas. Enough for today.